Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Jim Daniels. Jim Daniels' most recent books are Street, a collection of his poems along with the photos of Charlie Brodsky, Now Showing, a chapbook by AHA Dada Press, and his newest book, Revolt of the Crash Test Dummies, winner of the Blue Lynx Prize from Eastern Washington University Press. In fall 2007, his third collection of short stories, Mr. Pleasant, will be published by Michigan State University Press, and another collection of poems, In Line for the Exterminator, will be published by Wayne State University Press. Dumpster, the independent film he wrote and produced in 2006, has been shown at numerous film festivals. Hi, Jim. How you doing?
Hi, Jan.
You've been busy.
Thanks for having me.
You've been really busy. So please start reading. You have some new poems to share.
Sure. Okay. The first poem I'd like to read is going to be the title poem of the next collection, In Line for the Exterminator, and this is set at Kennywood Park, a familiar Pittsburgh landmark. And it's a dark roller coaster, so the little epigraph for the poem says a dark ride. Four skinheads swear and sweat and leather and fat behind my son and I, looping around endless circles of steel rails in a fake cinder block bunker. The ride simulates a trip through the bowels of sewers beneath the city. The skinny punks who cut in line jokingly press the panic button, a blaring echo that mimics nightmare fire alarms. They won't stop, though somebody's shouting, "Stop it!" Some young blacks with their girlfriends throw scowls at the skinheads. Perfume and deodorant and farts and spit and melting makeup and exposed skin pierced or not and tattoos and thick jewelry and tight clothing plastered against skin of all colors. My son's glassy-eyed with the room's menace. It stings, it clings. The line crawls like a whipped dog toward the dark door behind which, it's promised, we are all to be scared. A fake newscaster on a monitor describes a power failure. I want to ask, how many in this room make minimum wage? How many in this room will ever own your own house? What if we all make a giant wad of gum and roll it out of this park and onto the front lawn of the richest guy in the city? We have all paid our admission and had our hands stamped. Perhaps the walls are closing in on us. Hey, how many of you have been on this ride before? And I'll read the title poem of the current collection, Revolt of the Crash Test Dummies. Generals calculate the best weather for killing. They listen to the voices of satellites in the wind tunnel of the president's skull. They should hire my great aunt Martha's arthritic joints. The generals calculate the appropriate amount of uppers and downers pilots should take for optimum performance. They should hire my brother Steve, a truck driver. The generals calculate the appropriate syntax and diction with which to smokescreen and snow job. They should hire my brother-in-law Todd, the appliance salesman. Martha, Steve, and Todd, my country's brain trust, agree on the lunch menu and on keeping things in the family where no physical violence is allowed. The generals eat the latest in sugary cereals. They are anxious to wipe that smirk off somebody's face. The dummies drive off in clown cars, disappear in the distance. The generals wipe their glasses. They cough. With each cough, a door slams shut. This poem is called You Bring Out the Boring White Guy in Me, and it was in response to a student poem by Christina Acosta, who wrote a poem called You Bring Out the Dominican in Me, which sort of dealt with her emotions about being a Dominican in Pittsburgh and feeling, I think, a little isolated, and she found someone who brought out her home in her. It was really a love poem. But I was just thinking, well, what kind of poem can I write? So I wrote this. You bring out the boring white guy in me, the Ward Cleaver in me, the Pat Boone in me, the Kmart in me, the Slurpee in me, the boiled hot dog, the mac and cheese in me, the Tang in me. You bring out the hamburger helper in me, the Twinkie, the cheese whiz in me. You bring out the bowling trophy in me, the student council in me, the parliamentary procedure in me, the missionary position in me. You bring out the canned vegetables, the jello in me, the training wheels in me. You bring out the lawn edger in me, the fast food drive-through window in me, the value meal in me. You bring out the white briefs in me, the cheap beer and weak coffee in me. You bring out the 15% tip chart in me, the sad, overweight weekend golfer in me. You bring out the ex-smoker in me, the jumper cables in the trunk with flares and the red flag to tie to the window in me. You bring out the Tony Orlando in me, the canned situation comedy laughter in me, the elevator music in me, the medley of TV commercial jingles in me, the up with people in me. I've come to a complete stop at the stop sign. I've got my emergency flashers on. My doors are locked, baby, but I'm waiting for you.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Jim Daniels, reading his poetry. Okay, I'm not sure. I want to talk about that poem. I was identifying with a lot of those details, and I was thinking, oh, I think I'm boring too. But okay, that's another show. But I want to talk about your new book, The Revolt of the Crash Test Dummies. You know, everyone knows that you are a very prolific writer, and that you do, you know, turn out a lot of poems, which is it's really kind of amazing. But I want to talk about the difference that I see in these poems, and I want to see if you agree with this. It seems like some of these poems seem thicker to me in their movement, that there's less air in them, that there's more of unexplained leaping, maybe that there's a less direct narrative in some of them. Not so much the last poem that you read, but some of the others. Would you say that's something you're doing?
I think so. I mean, it's hard to analyze your own poems with any kind of distance, but I've been looking over the manuscript and proofreading it and things like that, and it does feel like there's a kind of looser, wackier sensibility at work sometimes in terms of making connections between things and hoping the white space will help the reader make the connections there.
Yeah, and almost like the poems are like turning on themselves, you know, in the middle, like unexplained direction changes, you know, that work in the poems, but surprising things happening.
Well, I've been trying to move away from too many straightforward narratives. Certainly, I started out as a pretty straightforward narrative poet, and I continue to write that kind of a poem, but I want to make room for other kinds of poems in my head and on the page as I get older.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, why, though, necessarily? I mean, because don't you think that one thing that we do as poets as we get older and as we grow as poets is just get better at the thing that we do, you know,
or
what I mean?
Become a self-parody, one or the other.
Yeah. Yeah,
but no, I've always been looking for challenges to rub against or to push against as a writer. That's one of the reasons I continue to write fiction. I've done this film work and working collaboration with Charlie Brodsky, who I continue to work with, just to change the field in one way or another. Because I guess I have a fear of repeating myself, which is a danger. You want to get better at what you do, but you don't want to seem like you're repeating moves you've made in the past. So I think you can think about it too much as a writer. You know, the writing hopefully will take care of itself,
right,
without you thinking about it too much.
Right, right. But I'm asking these questions, making you think about it. Christopher Buckley, the judge for the Blue Lynx Prize, which is the prize that you just won, said that you have a real ear for American phrasing, nothing pumped up, nothing inflated, which seems to me is a hallmark of your work, you know, to sort of nail that American phrasing. And are you saying that you're sort of moving away from that or not?
No, I don't think so. I'm trying to use it in different kinds of ways so that things seem a little more disconnected initially, and that I'm maybe allowing a little more room in the poem. I, you know, one of the things I get criticized for is for that kind of speech. So part of me, you know, has a little chip on my shoulder and say, no, this is important, and I'm going to keep writing it in this kind of voice. Mm-hmm. So the level and I think the straightforward diction is still there. So I don't think the poems are a little any more complicated in terms of the kind of language, but maybe how the language is used. And I've been thinking a lot about juxtaposition in terms of what things go next to each other mm-hmm. on the page.
Mm-hmm. Could you read more?
Sure. One of the places I keep coming back to, of course, is Detroit. And so I thought I would read a couple which are set there. I realize now I've lived over half my life in Pittsburgh, so this new book, in a way, is kind of half Pittsburgh and half Detroit. And one thing I'm pretty sure of is that I'm a city poet, because that seems to be my landscape. And this is a poem that looks back on some of my earlier poems about working in a car factory in Detroit. And the occasion of the poem is going to the Henry Ford Museum, which is a huge museum right outside Detroit near Ford World headquarters. And my father and my family and I went there when we were home for the holidays. And there was this quote on a robotics exhibit there, which is the epigraph of the poem. The poem's called American Dream. And the epigraph is, some of the jobs these machines replaced were difficult, boring, or dangerous. Others were good jobs that paid well and workers enjoyed. American Dream. My father, my children, my wife, and I were recruited to work on a toy car assembly line. My son placed the yellow plastic frame onto the conveyor. My wife snapped the red body onto the frame. My father snapped the blue seats in. I pushed the front end on. My daughter cranked the conveyor, controlling the speed. We each had a small box of parts. The museum employee in her perky red vest started a Chaplin-esque soundtrack, and we began, working smoothly till she instructed my daughter to crank faster. And we got backed up, tossing half-formed cars to the side. Faster, she kept telling her. We ran out of parts just as the music stopped. The employee counted the good cars and the bad. Bad outnumbered good. My son asked if we could keep the cars. She said no. In fact, we had to take them apart so that others could put them together again. My father and I had worked on assembly lines where if you couldn't keep up, you were fired, where time controllers assessed how long each job should take and set the line speed. The family that took our places asked me to videotape the whole thing. I wish I could say I was making this up. Inside, I felt the old humiliation throbbing again in my stooped back. I hated this woman bossing my daughter around. I told her I wanted to see my union rep, trying to keep it light, but she had a script to stick to and was probably making minimum wage herself. She didn't explain to us what we were supposed to take away from our experience, just not the cars. This next poem is called Efficiency, Bowling Green, Ohio. I lived in an ancient motel turned into efficiencies barely big enough for the double bed. Two electric burners and a sink. Four friends from Michigan came to visit. So happy to see them, I poured beer over their heads, up their sleeves. They, in turn, did not hurt me. I'd started smoking again. I blamed the whole state of Ohio. In that small town, you could walk everywhere and nowhere and in between. Three bars, two with the word dead in their names. The wind smacked us upside our drunken little heads. One friend, a woman, shared the bed with Mark. The rest of us lay on indoor-outdoor carpet in a U-shape around them. We listened to each other breathe in that stinky room. Months later, in the middle of a shower, the entire wall of plastic tiles crashed down on me. It could happen that quickly. An awkward bruise, an unfamiliar number, a misplaced ring. When the phone rang, I didn't answer it. Nobody did. They might have done something under the covers, Mark and Leanne. The sound would have been a blessing. Maybe I heard it. Maybe I didn't. In the morning, I made eggs and instant coffee and Tang. We stood without coats in a ravaged parking lot. I lived in number two. There was no number one. We smoked and coughed and laughed till they drove back to Michigan and I walked down to work at the corner grill. Maybe they'd stolen Mark's K and stuck him with a C. At least they didn't add an E on grill. My ex was back in Michigan. Her name ended in E. The woman I'd followed to Ohio was lost in between the O and the O, where the clouds had numbers and the hills were either imaginary or man-made or laced with unknown chemicals. I slept at the foot of the bed and was almost never happier. Four friends. If I was a dog, I'd have licked their feet. The U can be a beautiful letter, softly catching falling things. The room key attached to a large plastic motel jabbed my pocket like a worn knife. My friends convinced me to use my porch light for its radiant yellow, its optimistic glow, in case somebody might come home, even if it was only me. This next poem is called Wonder, and it goes back to Detroit again, where they turned the old Wonder Bread factory into one of Detroit's casinos, which might be something that Pittsburgh could pay attention to with its casino issue. Of course, the Wonder Bread slogan was Wonder Bread, build strong bodies 12 ways, and that's the epigraph for this poem. We toured the Wonder Bread factory, our blue and yellow scout uniforms jittering down the drab aisles of hum and clang. At the end of the line, we were allowed our taste of Detroit's assembly line communion, the workers silent as we passed, staring over our heads, numb with what they could not share. In their own uniforms, bare of arrows and awards, they disappeared into white bread. Back on the bus, I was drunk with the smell of warm bread emerging from giant ovens. In the stores, the spongy white loaves were covered in balloon-patterned plastic. What were the 12 ways? Eyes closed, my friend stroked his cheek with a warm slice. Wouldn't it be great to work here, he said. When we toured the Stroh's Brewery years later, he said the same thing. They offered no tours of auto plants. Yet that was where we ended up, parking our first cars in the enormous lined lots, fenced in, protected. Wouldn't it be great if communion tasted like this, Tony said. At home, my mother baked bread on rare occasions, her misshapen, yeasty loaves waiting warm in the kitchen after school. But they hardened quickly, the odd shapes sloppy for sandwiches. She made at least a dozen every night for school and work lunches, an assembly line of peanut butter and jelly, bologna and mustard, brown paper bags initialed for morning send-offs. That bakery is now the Motor City Casino, slots and chips clattering away the ghosts of loaves. The brewery's gone too, by the way, by the way, by the way, wayside. A money factory, what could be purer and sicker? I'm driving my car past that grand old factory, a building saved by greed, a rare Detroit victory against rubble. 12 ways. I hold up my three fingers to recite the old scout oath. I make the sign of the cross and recite the two prayers I remember. What I remember is you weren't supposed to chew. Just swallow and take it on faith.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Jim Daniels, reading from his new book, Revolt of the Crash Test Dummies. Boy, I love your poems on work. They're just so great.
Thanks. That's something I keep coming back to. And as a teacher, I'm writing poems about teaching, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember your tenured guy poems.
No, he's still around.
Yeah. Really? You're writing more tenured guy poems?
Occasionally, yeah.
Yeah. I was going to actually ask you about that because it seems to me that the ambivalence of the older tenured guy poems seems now to be in these newer poems, maybe a little more edgy and maybe a little more towards cynical in the voice. I mean, am I making that up? This voice seems so savvy and a little edgy to me. Is it the evolution of tenure guy or?
Well, I think I see it as a larger sort of edginess in response to the current political situation in the country. Some of the poems are in the book are explicitly political, and others are maybe less explicit about it. But for me, it's a pretty political book, and I think a lot of the edge comes from the sense of dissatisfaction and loss of faith in our country. You know, I have a couple of poems I think that might be a little more explicit about that in here too.
Okay, why don't you read a couple of those if you have them?
Yeah.
Because the voice is really in there, and, you know, I don't know if cynical is the right word, but you're saying it's more a response to a larger worldview.
Yeah, I think writing about small things, but also exploring the larger context in which these things are occurring. Flags. My children and I color the flags of imagined countries. We watch sleeping tenants across the street through sliding glass doors. Few bother with curtains. Few have anywhere to go for work. My son said cocaine for the first time today, singing, "I get a kick out of you from anything goes." Last week, we walked downtown to see it. He's almost 7. She's 5. The names of our new countries are unimportantly clever, our little secrets. "Wake up, sleepyheads," we sing softly. "They're not far away, the lives across the street." We're up early here. Our flags are sprinkled with kisses, eggs, eyeglasses, water, grass. My son has 3D glasses. My daughter, a whoopee cushion. The instructions on my new socks say, "Do not eat." We use invisible glue and tape. An exterminator shows up across the street. My flag is a big bar of soap. The country of happiness soap. I could never keep a secret. I do not know their names across the street. Last week, someone lost his life over there. No flagpole within blocks of here, but perhaps 1,000 invisible borders. Excuse me for being imprecise. My daughter colors a flag of hearts, but we cannot give a name to our own country.
So, you know, connecting that to what we were talking about, you see that poem as talking about the context for the voice in the book as a whole?
Or? Yeah, yeah. Whether I'm writing about Pittsburgh or Detroit or some surreal landscape, a lot of it is a reaction to the pressures and disappointments of the political landscape these days.
Mm-hmm. And the speaker in the book walking around in that landscape and speaking back to it or just living life in that context. So I guess that's the feeling I guess I was feeling as a reader. I was just feeling a very different sensibility in that voice. So
yeah, well, even with the title Revolt of the Crash Test Dummies, I guess I felt like we were often treated like crash test dummies in this country and just trying to speak up and wake ourselves up and respond in an effective communal way to some of the things that have been going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, and your next book that's coming out is called In Line for the Exterminator. So there's sort of, we were talking earlier about this apocalyptic sort of vision happening with your work.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that gives me hope, of course, is my children and their place in the world. And so they show up in ways that provide an antidote, I think, to some of these other things. So maybe I would read a couple poems where they show up, too. This is called Sledding in America. You can't sled everywhere in America. You need a hill. You need snow. On the way home, two cop cars blocked our street, their bodies askew, lights wowing the icy January air. I swerved around the back way and bounced up my driveway, hiding from whatever it was. Good old home, semi-sweet, etc. This afternoon, two parents came to blows on a sledding hill, ignoring the child with a head wound. I wanted to write nearly. My daughter and I pulled away as the ambulance arrived, as the police arrived. My daughter had been pleased that we'd slid all the way down into the hay barrels stacked at the bottom to keep us safe. She'd never seen adults actually come to blows. Her face was torn with it, the awkward mashing of flesh as they aimed at each other's heads, the vulnerable, unpadded place. You can't sled everywhere in America. You need, outside tires are spinning on ice, you need an alternate route. Climbing back up the hill, my daughter tired. "That's always part of the story," I told her on the way home, the car heating up slowly, evening light quickly fading, nearly immediate night. She talked about the advantages of sitting in front of the sled versus sitting behind me. I didn't want her to see that. Two madmen flailing against each other, sliding and tumbling down the hill together while the world stopped to blow on its cold hands. A nurse tended to that injured child while I tended to mine. You need a hill, you need snow, you need a warm place to go. "And now this," my daughter said as I circled the block. We didn't know what this was. We'd had enough for one day. Why do we hit each other? Why couldn't I pull her up the hill like I did last year? If we had a fireplace, I would build a fire. We sat on our old yellow kitchen floor pulling off boots. I don't know. I usually ran, I told her, my face burning. I saw everything and nothing. You need a way to steer or all the room in the world. And this is another Pittsburgh poem which deals with my neighborhood in Oakland and thinking about raising our children there. It's called Esperanza, which is Spanish for hope. I hung blue curtains framing January rain, a room for her. If she were to be born, if she lived, if she fooled the harmonica-blowing Grim Reaper doing his fandango out in the puddles, I wanted to give my daughter that name. I climbed down from the ladder to feel her stir inside you. Across the street, a hand dropped a small vial into an open car window. I cursed the view. Should we move? Where? I called the police again. The next day, in the hospital safe glare, we named her Rosalie, not caring what it meant. I had wanted to shout in the cold rain streaming down, threatening snow, without getting shot. Our daughter turns one today. Soon our lights will click on automatically, darkness voracious. You nurse her to sleep. The exotic word for hope rises unspoken. We are still here.
It's the poetry of Jim Daniels, reading from his new book, Revolt of the Crash Test Dummies. Thank you so much, Jim, for being here.
My pleasure, Jan. Thanks.
Okay. I want to mention also that you'll be reading at the Sphinx Cafe in Oakland on April 10th at 8 p.m., corner of Atwood and Bates. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. Our sound engineers are Joseph Wilk and Lauren Wolf. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, here on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.